Blog Talk Radio. Greetings, this is Rabbi King Azikiwe, and welcome back to another edition of the Pan-African Journal. The Pan-African Journal is an audio news magazine that's brought to you here on a weekly basis. I am your host, Abayomi Azikiwe. Today is Sunday, March the 24th, 2024. We're broadcasting from our studios in downtown Detroit. We'd like to thank all of our listeners for tuning in once again to yet another edition of the Pan-African Journal, this special edition of our program. Later on, we'll be bringing you our regular Pan-African Newswire report. We'll feature dispatches on a recent attack on the Niger military personnel inside of that West African Sahel state. Algeria and North Africa has set national elections for this coming September. Kenyan doctors in East Africa remain on strike for the second week. And refugee camps in Chad are overflowing new migrants. In the second and third hours, we continue our focus on International Women's History Month with segments on the impact of the Memphis Massacre of 1866 on African-American women and the hidden speeches of Coretta Scott King during the 1960s, 70s, and 80s. These and other features are going to be brought to you during the course of our program. Stay tuned. We'd like to take our musical interlude with the music of Mijer 30, who is from the Democratic Republic of Congo. Let's listen in.
Como una gata con un corazón. kongola ekenda oye mite nini oyo ndombe asalelanga pona sombaka bete moto kudu oya mokili soki apesi eloko sengi mesi ebongo kolo itema ye opesi ye nini okomonanga ntango nyonso nazelaka nga ya eklesia oyebi te nini oyo nzambe asalelanga mpo nasalelaka yeyeye angayo nazali reconnaissante ye makambo asalelanga ya binene papa yo nauti na libulu ya masumu abimisinga yo etika nazalaki ya liwa ya bimisinga yo mikolo na ngai ya kovivre ekomaki nde ya kotanga ye pongi na ngai na butu kaka bandota mabe nanakopesanga loboko moto na moto na oya ye nakanisaki libota na ngai kosunganga epesaki nga mokongo nasimbaki moto na kolela ye batelekelaki yo nango angayo momoni ntina ngai nalingaka ye nalabandai nabina ngai yo nakosalela ye abeta ekuke ya motema na ngai na fungoli ya koti
Baba songi songi.
Comisão aí que vem, só que assim me engana, nem a caia que me dá, é, só
Thank you. Yeah. Thank you. Mama, Papa, ata o matin suka
popolele moshu
mobine me metro resongo me na poto la vele tu es mon amour tu es mon cœur tu es tout ce que je rêve
Republic of Congo, a collection of her songs. And you're listening to the Pan-African Journal, special worldwide radio broadcast for Sunday, March 24th, 2024. We are broadcasting from our studios in downtown Detroit. Right now, we'd like to move into our Pan-African Newswire segment. These are some of the headlines in today's Pan-African Newswire. Algeria will hold its next elections on September the 7th. And, of course, that is going to be a very important event, giving first-term President Abdelmadjid Tebboune more than 5 months to campaign should he decide to seek a second term leading the oil-rich North African state. Tebboune offices announced the date in a statement just 3 days ago, after meeting with a group that included high-ranking members of parliament and the constitutional court, as well as its independent election authority. Only Zubida Assoul of the Union for Change and Progress has come forward to challenge Tebboune, who has not officially announced plans to seek re-election as president of the country of 44 million people, which is facing mounting political and economic challenges. The announcement took the nation by surprise, as elections in Algeria had been expected to take place on December of 2024, raising the speculation among observers about the rationale for the changes. And in the West African state of Niger, there are reports of attacks on military forces during a sweep operation. Nigerian soldiers were trapped in clashes against an armed group. Niger's defense minister revealed that 23 soldiers were killed in what they described as a terrorist ambush during a sweep operation in a western area bordering Burkina Faso and Mali. The ministry said the complex ambush took place in Tillaberi and the three border areas in which Nigerian soldiers clashed against terrorists, killing 30 of them. Security sweep operation conducted by the Nigerian army aimed at reassuring locals and their safety against the recurrent targeting, murders, extortion, and cattle rustling actions opposing armed groups which they have engaged in with. However, during the operation, almost 100 armed men attacked the army force using homemade bombs and suicide vehicles, killing 23 of the national military forces. You're listening to the Pan-African Newswire segment of the Pan-African Journal. Hundreds of Kenyan doctors protested in the streets on Friday, demanding better pay and working conditions in an ongoing nationwide strike that has entered its second week. The doctors carried placards and chanted against the Kenyan government, saying it had failed to implement a raft of promises, including a collective bargaining agreement signed in 2017 after a 100-day strike during which people died from lack of care. Kenyan medical practitioners, pharmacists, and dentists Union Secretary General Dr. Davji Bihemji said the strike will continue until all the demands are met. And finally, overcrowded refugee camps in eastern Chad are set to run out of money soon, exacerbating a dire humanitarian crisis caused by the spillover from a deadly conflict in the Republic of Sudan. That's according to United Nations officials. More than a million people in Chad, including refugees, face losing access to life-saving aid unless more funding is raised to help, the UN World Food Program said this month. The devastating conflict between feuding generals in Sudan has killed more than 5,000 people there and displaced over 5 million, the United Nations said. In Chad, refugee numbers are at a 20-year high. The UN has warned that the conflict is on course to become the world's worst hunger crisis, with a third of Sudan's 18 million people facing acute food insecurity already. With that, we'll conclude this segment, the Pan-African Newswire segment of the Pan-African Journal. In concluding the Pan-African Newswire, we'd like to remind our listeners that the Pan-African Newswire is an international electronic press service. It is designed to foster intelligent discussions on the affairs of African people throughout the continent and the world. The press agency was founded in January of 1998. Since then, it has published tens of thousands of articles and dispatches in hundreds of newspapers, magazines, journals, research reports, and on blogs and websites throughout the world. The Pan-African Newswire represents the only daily international news source on Pan-African and global affairs. If you'd like to log on to the Pan-African Newswire so you can stay abreast of some of the most pressing and burning issues of the day, all you need to do is go to our website at panafricannews.blogspot.com. That's panafricannews.blogspot.com. If you'd like to have access to today's Pan-African Journal special worldwide radio broadcast, just go to the Pan-African Radio Network. That's at blogtalkradio.com/Pan-African Journal. That's blogtalkradio.com/Pan-African Journal. We'll take a break. We'll be back with more of the Pan-African Journal for this week.
heard it said all across the universe, just seek and ye shall find. I started out all along and lonely earth, for the love is in your eyes. Making sense out of my life, oh, appearing just when I was losing faith, for making all the wrong seem right.
Hyman with her rendition and cover of the track entitled I Found Love. You're listening to the Pan-African Journal, special worldwide radio broadcast. This is International Women's History Month. Right now we're going to look at the Memphis Race Massacre of 1866. And Dr. Beverly Bond, professor of history at the University of Memphis, is featured in this report. Let's listen in.
Well, thanks everyone for joining us. Good afternoon. Welcome to Munch and Learn. We're going to go over just a few pieces of information and we'll get right to it. We are recording this session beginning now. Each week's talk is published on the Dixon's YouTube channel in case you'd ever like to go back and revisit another talk. Since we're recording, we do ask for everyone to remain on mute And if for some reason you accidentally unmute, which does happen, please don't be offended if we hit that button for you. I'm your host this week, Sarah Lorenz, the Special Events Manager at the Dixon. And today we're going to hear from Dr. Beverly Bond as she tells us about the 1866 Memphis Massacre and its impact on the lives of Black women, as well as how moments like these from history are represented and retold. If you have any questions throughout this presentation, please feel free to type them in the chat. We'll get to them afterwards. And now I'd like to introduce Dr. Beverly Bond. Dr. Bond is a professor in the Department of History at the University of Memphis and former director of the College of Arts and Sciences African and African American Studies Program. Her research interests center on the enslaved, free, and freed African American women and African American families in the 19th century South. Dr. Bond has co-edited or co-authored at least 6 publications that deal with this topic and specifically how they relate to Memphis, and I will list these in the chat. Dr. Bond has also served previously as the president for the Southern Association for Women Historians, as president and board members of Humanities Tennessee, and is currently on the board of trustees of the Memphis Museum of Science and History, Pink Palace, the board of advisors of the Tennessee Civil War National Heritage Area, and the Tennessee Historical Records Advisory Board. Dr. Bond, the floor is yours.
Okay, sorry. Thank you, Sarah. You have to excuse me as I have this kind of clearing of my throat all the time. I think this is what they call the Memphis crud. And from someone who was born and raised in Memphis, I am very, very much accustomed to it, as are most of my students. But I think after a while, if I just keep drinking my water and my coffee, it should clear up. I'd like to thank the Dixon for inviting me to do this presentation. I was a little unsure as to how I would try to link all of this with the Dixon, because I really don't think that there are any illustrations or photographs or whatever that really will allow you to get an idea of what was happening at this period in 19th century Memphis. And I should also point out that this coming weekend is actually the 155th anniversary of this event. So this is a very timely presentation. And if you give me just 1 second, I will, and hopefully everything will just work out very quickly, very nicely, I'll switch over to just a few slides, which I will kind of use to lead into a presentation on this lecture. Now, I hope that you all came prepared with your lunches to sit through a nice, maybe about 15, 20 minute lecture. And I hope that I won't be speaking too quickly, but I would like to just move through that and then just save enough time for you to ask me questions about the event and about how we commemorated this 150th anniversary of the event 5 years ago. So let me just go over to this. And okay, now these subtitles referenced down at the bottom should just kind of disappear in just a few minutes. But I'm going to just title this lecture, the first part of it, the overall theme of it, Remembering the Memphis Massacre, an American Story. And I'm using this title because this is the title of a book that grew out of the commemoration of the event 5 years ago. And then I'm going to subtitle it, The Impact of the 1866 Memphis Massacre on the Lives of Black Women. Now, what you're looking at right now is obviously a historical marker. And this historical marker, the placement of this marker, in many ways was one of the launching events or whatever to get us into this commemoration of the marker. The marker was placed 5 years ago. It's around the corner from the Civil Rights Museum downtown on MLK Boulevard. The marker was sponsored by the National Park Service and by the NAACP, the Memphis chapter of the NAACP. And there's a long story about why the marker is there and how it kind of, how these this coalition of these two groups, or this union of these two groups came about to produce the marker, because I think most people know that historical markers are usually done in Memphis, either by the Shelby County Historical Association or by the Tennessee Historical Association. But this one's a little bit different. And I can answer questions about this in the Q&A, but this marker tells a lot about the event. It tells a lot about why we commemorated it 5 years ago. And Remembering the Memphis Massacre is actually the title of a book that grew out of this commemoration. The book was published about a year ago. And unfortunately, it came out at about the same time as the coronavirus pandemic hit. So there is not a lot of, we only did one, I guess, book event for this, for the publication, and that was at Booksellers, which was the event was very well attended. The book is a collection of essays that were presented by some leading historians on Southern history, on Civil War history, and also on the rhetoric of the 19th century. I'm not going to go into a list of names, but I will just give a lot of credit to my co-editor, Susan Evo O'Donovan, who is also my colleague at the University of Memphis. And in the picture, you'll see Dr. O'Donovan and me, as we were kind of in our, what we like to call our sub office, working on some events or some information or some presentations for the whole period of the commemoration of the Memphis Massacre. Our little office is, of course, this is either Panera Bread or Starbucks, but that's our other office. We actually share some office space, an office suite at the university, but we kind of like to get away from that every once in a while, but not like we have been for the whole year. So, into the massacre. Again, there is not a lot that I can show you in terms of visual references of what Memphis looked like, or even what the massacre looked like, what this event looked like in the 1860s. However, these illustrations are from Harper's Weekly. And this is an illustration that shows Memphis after the Civil War. Memphis after the massacre even. You see a large or small group of African Americans, probably free people. You see the city in the background. You see some small houses that were developing. And one of the things that this particular illustration reveals is a growing number of African Americans who were coming into the city from about 1862 till about 1866. And what this meant, if you're looking at the history of Memphis, is that during that Civil War period, the black population in the city actually quadruples. Part of this is in the aftermath, obviously, of the fall of Memphis to the Union Navy, the Battle of Memphis on the river, but the fall of Memphis to the Union Navy, and then the situating of Union troops in the city, the construction of a large Union fort on the banks of the Mississippi, Fort Pickering, that was located near what is now the Ornamental Metal Museum. And those of you who remember Spaghetti Warehouse, it extended all the way down to where Spaghetti Warehouse was located years ago. So that was the Union Fort. And as African Americans began to escape or leave plantations and farms in Arkansas, East Arkansas, in Western Tennessee, and Northern Mississippi, many of them came to Memphis because Memphis represented sanctuary. As a Union fort was here, and as Union troops were here. large numbers of women, which I'll mention in just a few minutes, also came and brought their children with them. This is an illustration of what was referred to as the colored orphan asylum. Although all of these children were not orphaned, many of them were brought to the city and were housed in this orphan's home, this orphanage, as a protection, as a way of providing food and shelter, and as a place sometimes where African-American women, often their mothers, could find jobs. And then this is an illustration of the Freedmen's Bureau office in Memphis in the late period of the Civil War and into 1866, 1867. So this might give you some idea of who's there, what the city might have looked like. And then, of course, this is another Harper's illustration of the riot itself or the massacre. So, and I'll talk a little bit about question and answer about why this shift from referring to the event as a riot and calling it a massacre. Okay, so let me introduce some of the women and tell you something about what is happening in Memphis during this period. And I'm just going to leave this this particular frame up so you have a visual reference. And I'm going to start with a woman by the name of Celia Simmons. Okay, I'd like if you can just bear with me for about the next 15 minutes. I was telling Sarah before we started that thankfully you can't see me up here shuffling papers and everything, but my students, when I'm actually in a physical classroom, they know that if I don't actually have something to refer to as what we call a lecture with papers on paper, then I can talk for a long time. So my students usually welcome the sight of all of these papers that I'm going to refer to because they know that at some point I will stop talking and they will get a chance to talk now. So anyway, you can't see the papers, but they're here. And the title of this lecture is, I'm a Woman, I'm a Woman, Gender and the 1866 Memphis Massacre. Celia Simmons thought that she had no choice but to open her door to the persistent knocking of two armed men. It was 3 o'clock in the morning. Her usually calm neighborhood had not been quiet for 2 days as marauding gangs of armed white men terrorized the community. Black men, women, and children had been beaten, robbed, and murdered. Their houses, churches, and schoolrooms had been burned to the ground. Fearing that his presence would incite the anger of the intruders, Celia's husband, Anthony, ran from their home as soon as the knocking began. Only Celia and her children remained in the cabin. Two of her daughters huddled together on one bed, while the other children crowded into their parents' bed. As expected, the intruders began looking for Anthony Simmons as soon as they entered the shanty. Although Celia told them her husband was not at home, they continued their search. A movement in one of the beds caught one man's attention, and despite a warning from his partner that there were children present, he aimed his gun in the direction of the bed where Celia's terrified daughters lay. The older girl cried out, "Oh, I'm a woman, I'm a woman," as the man fired his gun. The bullet passed through her fingers and upper arm and lodged in her breast. Her younger sister was also injured as the bullet whizzed past her open mouth. "Lord, I've shot a woman," shouted the assailant as he ran from the room. Both of Celia Simmons' daughters survived their wounds, but other African-American women, many only a few months or years removed from bondage, were not so lucky. In the three-day massacre in May of 1866, 46 Black Memphians, including several girls and women, were killed. 5 women were raped. Hundreds of other Black Memphians were wounded, robbed, and terrorized. Only 2 white men were killed, and perhaps 2 or 3 white women were victimized. The testimony African-American women gave to the committees investigating the Memphis massacre suggests, one, that Black women were not viewed as women who could claim the same gender privileges as white women. And two, although freed by presidential proclamation, the Emancipation Proclamation, of course, and constitutional amendment, the 13th Amendment, Black women still found themselves burdened by paradigms of their sexuality and sexual availability that had clung to generations of enslaved women. However, this same testimony also revealed that African-American women refused to be bound by these rules of behavior and asserted their rights to their bodies, their property, and their freedom. In this lecture, I'd like to tell you about freed women's migration experiences and how they experienced the Memphis Massacre. The exact timing of the 1866 Memphis Massacre was probably the only surprising aspect of the three-day-long racial rampage in which mobs of whites attacked and pillaged Black neighborhoods in South Memphis. Memphians who later testified before committees investigating the violence suggested that months of planning must have gone into this rampage and that the riot was part of the reconstruction or construction of race relations in the post-Civil War city. Thousands of Blacks migrated into Memphis in the aftermath of the city's fall to Union forces in June of 1862. By 1865, the African-American population had increased dramatically from a pre-Civil War total of about 4,000 to well over 16,000. About 58% of whom, of this total population, were women. Most of these freed people sought sanctuary in the Union-controlled city, as well as economic and social opportunities that had eluded them as enslaved people in the rural countryside. For most fugitives, particularly women and girls, the journey to Memphis had been a risky endeavor. Tilly Watts left her home to find a job as a cook for the men in the camps, meaning the contraband camps that had formed around Fort Pickering. She was accosted en route to Memphis by several white men, raped and held prisoner in a wagon outside of the city, before she was sold to a white family that was migrating from Tennessee to Texas. This was during the Civil War. Hester Swafford made it into Memphis, but was captured and returned to her owners. Hester's daughter recalled the brutal punishment her mother suffered for the escape attempt. Her owner sent an overseer to bring her back from the city, then had her whipped and sent back to the fields to chop cotton all day long. Other enslaved women cared for her wounds when her work was done. Women who successfully escaped to the city, with or without accompanying husbands, fathers, and their children, began the transition from slavery to freedom in these contraband camps that had been set up to house the thousands of fugitives and refugees coming to the city. By 1863-64, several camps were located near the Union's Fort Pickering or on President's Island, or in the surrounding areas in north of the fort. Black men in camps who were considered physically able might be drafted to build fortifications or eventually into Black regiments in the Union Army. By 1864, most of the inhabitants in the contraband camps were women and children. The typical female inhabitant was illiterate, unskilled, usually she had been a farmhand, a field hand, and was accompanied by children. Some pregnant or sick, some of the women were pregnant or sickly, and more women than men died soon after reaching the city. African American community life began in the camps, and Blacks moved into neighborhoods in the city, moved from the camps into neighborhoods. Schools and independent churches, as well as small businesses, emerged in what became known as South Memphis, as their South Memphis community. And I can answer the question on whether it was there earlier, what exactly what was South Memphis, even before the Civil War. Black women were important to these social and economic developments. Emancipation and migration also offered opportunities for remaking ideas of Black manhood and womanhood. Black men and women could choose when, whether, and how to live and to work, as well as with whom to share households and to build families. Most freed people probably expected federal, military, and/or civilian authorities to protect them and their property, and few, if they were aware of it, may have taken President Lincoln's admonition that the Union would be restored with malice toward none and charity for all. Few of them took it personally. However, while the Civil War had settled the question of Black slavery, it could not guarantee that new constructions of African-American manhood, womanhood, or claims to citizenship would be honored or even understood by white Memphians. Racial paradigms were shifting. Black and white men and women seemed uncertain as to where the new boundaries would finally be drawn. Local newspapers were filled with stories of small and large confrontations that seemed to illustrate one white Memphian's opinion that, quote, the Negroes are getting a little larger in their own estimation than white people, and they must be taken down a little. And of course, the president, who had called for speedy reconstruction in 1865, had been assassinated very soon after he had been sworn into his second term. In Memphis and Shelby County, as in other parts of the South, interracial violence or the threat of violence was always present. For example, in September of 1863, Jim, a Black man, killed James Dunlap, described as, quote, a very respectable young white man, end of quote, on Dunlap's Tipton County farm. Jim, who may have been a runaway a few months earlier, was trying to return to his former owner's farm near the Dunlap farm. Not knowing what awaited him at his old home, Jim decided to stop first and visit his wife on a neighboring plantation. But to do so, he had to cross Dunlap's property. Dunlap, on horseback, blocked Jim's path and threatened to punish him for trespassing. Jim's response was that, quote, he would exercise his own judgment about that and that he was as good a man as Dunlap was. When Dunlap got down from his horse and grabbed the Black man by the collar, Jim stabbed him 3 times before running back to Memphis. He was arrested later that evening. Had both men been white, Dunlap probably would have considered allowing Jim to cross his land to visit his wife. But for Dunlap, Jim's words and actions were evidence of the newspaper writer's admonition that, quote, Negroes are getting a little larger in their own estimation than white people. African-American women were also getting a little larger in their own estimation. While many 19th century Americans considered concern for marriage and family to be womanly virtues, white employers felt that these same attitudes in a freed woman's behavior had to be balanced against their roles as laborers. However, formerly enslaved women measured their freedom by the extent to which they could create and sustain families with or without male assistance or white interference. Ideas on work, domestic relationships were tied to concerns for the emotional and economic welfare of their families. African American women also claimed the right to make decisions about their sexuality. White men and women acknowledged freed women's responsibilities for the welfare of their families, but they frequently rejected their claims to ownership of the women's time, labor, families, and their bodies. This denial of gender equity extended to other areas of Black women's lives. Their physical appearances were demeaned, and assertive behavior, no matter how justified, was branded as unladylike, even though they weren't considered to be ladies. One local newspaper described many of the women, black women, who appeared in local courts as, quote, as feminine only in name, for their actions bespoke them to be very masculine in their deportment. So there is this kind of shifting gender concept during this period. Many of these defendants were black women charged with keeping disorderly houses and gambling resorts, being disorderly at black eating houses, fighting, stealing, harassing white men and women. Newspaper stories frequently omitted black women's surnames and labeled them as what were described as wenches, degenerate females of sable skin, over-vicious colored individuals, unruly females of African race, combative Africans of female persuasion. All these different negative connotations were used to describe African-American women in newspaper articles. This public defeminization created a climate in which violent attacks on black women were considered acceptable and even necessary tools for establishing and maintaining social and economic order in the post-Civil War South. Okay, now let me shift very quickly to the massacre itself, the Memphis Massacre. Simmering racial tensions and confrontations created the climate for the Memphis Massacre, but the mustering out and disarming of the 3rd U.S. Colored Heavy Artillery in late April of 1866 was the immediate catalyst. On Monday, April the 30th, 4 Memphis policemen and 3 or 4 African-American soldiers were involved in a confrontation. Witnesses later testified that the policemen encountered the soldiers and the groups exchanged words as the black men moved to let the policemen pass by. One of the black men fell down and the policeman tripped over him as he was trying to get by. The other policemen drew their pistols and knives, and when the man who had fallen started to leave, the policeman ran after him. A fight began between the soldiers and the police, but this was eventually suppressed. However, the next day, a crowd of about 100 African-American soldiers and civilians gathered in the Memphis neighborhood, in that neighborhood, around what was called South Street. Another crowd of policemen assembled nearby, and black soldiers cheered Abe Lincoln, the reference, of course, to the assassinated president. The policeman responded, quote, "Your old father, Abe Lincoln, is dead and damned." 2 black men were eventually arrested in a free-for-all that followed this exchange. Black soldiers fired their guns into the air as police managed to escape with their prisoners, but the policemen soon returned with reinforcements. This kind of what was described as promiscuous running, violence, and fights continued into the night. The mayor of Memphis, Mayor John Clark, went to the military at that point and asked the commanding officer, General George Stoneman, if he would send reinforcements to suppress the violence. But Stoneman refused to do this because he reminded Clark that at this point in Memphis history, control of the city had actually shifted from the military and back to the civilian authorities. So Stoneman said very simply, this is not our responsibility. It is the responsibility of the city government to handle these difficulties. On the morning of May the 2nd, the county court judge asked Stoneman again for weapons to arm a posse that was being organized by the mayor. But the general again refused. And armed with weapons from a local store and anything else they could get their hands on, the white mob returned to South Memphis, the South Memphis neighborhood, at about 11 a.m. As some of the soldiers, black soldiers, who had been told by Stoneman that they could not leave the fort, even though the violence was occurring in neighborhoods where their families were living. And their families were very often targeted for this violence. The soldiers had been told by Stoneman that they couldn't leave the fort to protect their families. And if they left, if they managed to sneak out, that they could not take weapons with them. So they were basically confined to the fort and left to just watch the violence as it occurred throughout the rest of that day, May the 2nd, and into the night. General Stoneman did send a letter to the mayor and the city council on May the 2nd, stating that the military would intervene at some point, as I think Stoneman observed or could observe that the mayor was indeed organizing a posse and that the violence would probably become even worse if this happened. Stoneman told Park that he would, have some level of military intervention at that point. And this, of course, did happen. The military stepped in. They quelled the violence. There were isolated incidents that continued for the next couple of days. But by May the 3rd, the violence that you see illustrated in this photograph had pretty much, ended. What happened to Black women during the 3 days of violence reflected the denial of gender equity or the refusal to grant them the same gender privileges as white women and continuing efforts to keep them in their antebellum, quote, places. The public nature of freed women's lives and labor placed them on the city streets from the beginning of the violence. As the confrontations between soldiers and policemen escalated, Black women who were working as cooks and domestic servants found themselves, of course, caught in this violence because they had to shop for their employers. Black washerwomen were collecting and delivering laundry to their clients, and Black domestic servants were coming and going to work. So they were caught in the midst of all the violence that was occurred with very little possibility of escaping it. Black women also witnessed the confrontations from their porches and their windows. Hannah George, for example, saw the first clashes from the doorway of Ryan's store on South Street before she sought the safety of her cabin nearby. She later testified that she thought the police and the soldiers would soon get over it, that they would just kind of stop all this fighting, just as they seemed to do on other occasions. Other women, and obviously they didn't, not for a while, other women were among the crowds of Blacks who chased or were chased by policemen and mobs of white men. Margaret Gardner, for example, reported seeing a woman walking with the Black soldier when some policemen tried to arrest him. When the soldier resisted, the policeman threw him into a wagon and beat him all the way to the station house. Gardner also recalls seeing men and women running to see what they, the assailants and their victims, were going to do. Other women watched the fighting from a grocery store on Front Street and South Street. Adeline Miller and Jenny Menard were two women who found themselves in this position. Young Adeline, when the violence started, ran into the store, but the owners threw her out. And of course, let me go back, she had just been shopping that day. She just found herself in front of the store at that point. And when she tried to get in and avoid the violence, the owners refused to let her stay. They threw her out of the store. Adeline was attacked, and she died from wounds that she received when she was shot, and probably just from a stray bullet. Her body was taken into the store that had thrown her out, where it remained on public display until her parents retrieved it the following day. So black women, again, are caught in the midst of this. Black women also found themselves victims of sexual violence. Mobs often targeted freed women that they knew had some association with the Union Army. For example, two white men came to Harriet Armour's cabin to search for guns, which they thought she was holding for a neighbor who lived nearby. The men also asked where Armour's husband was, and she told them that he was in the fort. He was a soldier. Her husband was, in fact, one of the of several black soldiers who, again, were confined to Fort Pickering by General Stoneman and who could not get out to protect their families. The intruders searched Armour's belongings for weapons and valuables before barring the cabin door and raping her. She later testified to the investigating committees that she felt powerless to defend herself from the assaults and was afraid to call for help. Quote, I was there alone, was sick, and was weak, and I thought I would rather let them do it than to be hurt or punished. I thought I'd just better give up freely. I did not like to do it, but I thought it was best for me. Armour's case, Armour's situation, is one of the most interesting cases in the testimony about the violence of the riot. Because Armour's next door neighbor was a white woman, Molly Hayes. And Molly claimed that she really didn't know what was going on, even though if you'll notice from this, Molly and Harriet probably lived in housing that was very much like this. So if Molly was on one side, then Harriet was on the other side. But Molly claimed that, you know, she had no idea what was happening and that all she knew was that she thought Harriet had actually let the men in, which, you know, Harriet said she did because she was afraid. And from that point, Molly decided it was time to leave. And she essentially left her house rather than intervene with what was happening. Now, Harriet's neighbor on the other side was a black woman, and her description of what happened was a little bit different. Molly said Harriet let the men in. The other neighbor, a woman by the name of Cynthia, said, well, Cynthia Townsend said, well, no, Harriet tried to defend herself and fought the men off. So it was these two different interpretations that really reflected ideas of differing ideas of gender and of race during this period. Were black women willing participants in this violence, this sexual violence, or were they attempting to claim their own sexuality, to say that I have no choice on this, they're going to kill me because I only have the experiences of decades of slavery in my background to tell me that this is what is going to happen, that I do not have a right to my body. Now, one of the most interesting things, and I'll probably stop at this point so we'll have time for some questions. One of the most interesting things as far as women's experiences are concerned, whether it's with the sexual violence of the riot, whether it's with the destruction of their homes, with the killing of their children, with the burglaries in which some members of the mob would just simply go into a woman's, black woman's house and just steal her clothing. And this especially happened to women that were known to have connections with soldiers in the fort. One of the things that happens in the aftermath is that these women decide that they will testify to what happened. And it is that kind of testifying and saying that this happened to me and it should not have happened that really reflected a changing attitude on the part of freed women, black women during this period, a changing attitude in terms of what they saw as being their right to possess their bodies, their right to possess their property. All of this comes out during as a result of the riot itself. So I'm going to stop at this point, and so we'll have about 15 minutes for questions and answers, and I think you could probably address any other questions that you might have during this time. Let's see if I can cover this.
Thank you much, very, very much, Dr. Bond.
Okay. No.
We have one question that we've received in the chat so far. And
I'm surprised, just one question?
Well, sometimes we're a shy group.
Okay.
The question is, what was the year that that marker that you identified for us in the beginning was placed? And the partner, okay, that's question number one.
I'll do that one real quick. 2016.
Okay. And would you remind us of the location?
It is on MLK Boulevard. And it's not on Mulberry. I think it's one street over. I kept trying to remember what the exact street is. But it is just around the corner from the Civil Rights Museum. So if you come out of the Civil Rights Museum and you walk down toward MLK Boulevard, it's about one street over from that.
Thank you.
It's in Army Navy Park, which I'd never, you know, I'm a native Memphian, and I had to be reminded that Army Navy Park was down there, but it's in Army Navy Park.
Thank you. The last part of that question is the partnership that brought that plaque to us was between the NAACP and which other group?
The National Park Service. Yeah, let me just tell you how that happened. The National Park Service had been sponsoring events related to commemorations of the Civil War. And they could do this very easily, if I could put it that way, because with Civil War commemorations, you have an actual site that they can go to and say, okay, we're going to commemorate the Battle of Shiloh, or we're going to commemorate the Battle of Bull Run, Manassas. And they could hold a commemoration there. And they did this throughout the whole period of that 150th anniversary or 145th anniversary, the whole commemoration period for the Civil War. They could do that. And then as they got to the end of that series of commemorations, of course, the next set of events is the Reconstruction period. But Reconstruction traditionally has not been a period that many people see as being, it's actually nothing there to commemorate physically. And for many historians, for many teachers, it's a period that you kind of skip over. And you say, okay, well, Lincoln was assassinated, and then there was military Reconstruction, and there was the Freedmen's Bureau, and then that ended in with the election of 1877. So you kind of like go through it very quickly without any real significant commemorations, because you have to figure out what are the sites of commemoration. And the National Park Service, one of the, not a ranger, but the managers of one of the administrative sites, contacted Susan and I because, you know, as we were getting close to 2016, he said, okay, so what are you all doing to commemorate the Memphis Massacre? Well, Dr. Susan O'Donovan and I we knew it was coming up, and we figured, of course, we'd talk about it in our classes, but we really didn't have a commemoration in mind, you know, because, you know, who commemorates an event of the Reconstruction period? So after the Park Service got in touch with us, we said, okay, well, maybe we'll figure out how we could do a community commemoration of it. Now, at that same time, the NAACP had contacted us to act as kind of like historical references to make sure that all of their information was correct, because they wanted to place a marker commemorating the Memphis Massacre. These were like two independent things that are happening that kind of converge. So there's one group that's saying, will you help us out and make sure all the information on the marker is correct? And the other group is saying, will you figure out how you can commemorate the Reconstruction period? And the massacre in Memphis was actually one of the first main events, violent events, of the Reconstruction period. And the massacre in Memphis, I should just say, I hated to end it at the point where I did, but I did want to leave some time for questions. It is a very significant event in terms of national history. And most people didn't realize this because in 1866, this is a period where Lincoln had been assassinated. You're entering that period where Reconstruction is essentially going to be continue to be controlled by the executive branch of government. But the executive branch of government, the president at that point, is Andrew Johnson from Tennessee. And of course, Tennesseans all know the history of, you know, what is going on at this point, that he is vice president. Tennessee was a Confederate state. Tennessee was not included under the Emancipation Proclamation because, you know, Tennessee is a kind of divided state, and it would, and some of Tennessee's representatives, including Johnson, never really left Congress. So you could say it was a Confederate state, it was a part of the Confederacy, but maybe some parts of it weren't. So it's kind of like an unusual situation at that point. But anyway, so when they're at this point, in the aftermath of, or at this point, there's this growing demand on the part of Northern Republicans that maybe what they need to do is shift from presidential control of Reconstruction to congressional control of Reconstruction. But they hadn't quite done that, and the violence was increasing. And with things like the Memphis Massacre showed, this was a demonstration to people in Congress, and that was, of course, one of the reasons that they had these investigating committees that came to kind of, you know, talk to people and see what had gone on, kind of showed that the South was not reconstructed, that, you know, this idea that Lincoln had, that there would be a quick Reconstruction, we would get the states back into the Union, and that's what reconstructed meant. It meant that states were back in Congress. Their representatives were back in Congress. And, of course, Tennessee was on the verge of being able to do this, of getting their representatives in. Well, this was a demonstration that maybe the South wasn't ready to be reconstructed. So you've got this massacre, this violence that's taking place in Memphis in May. Then you have violence that's taking place in New Orleans in June. Then you have increasing violence in other parts of the South, so that these representatives could go to Congress and say, you know, maybe we need to shift the whole idea of Reconstruction and move to some idea of military control and then congressional control. And maybe we need to think about making that Civil Rights Act of 1866, maybe we need to think about putting this concept of citizenship, this question of Black citizenship, into the Constitution as a 14th Amendment. So there is this line or this connection from the Memphis Massacre to the 14th Amendment. That's one key significance of this, that out of this massacre, to some extent, you have the 14th Amendment.
Excellent piece of information. We actually, after we said we only had one question, we have a lot more questions.
Wow, that's good.
Michael Baker.
It's G.E. Patterson. I'm sorry. I'm saying MLK. It's G.E. Patterson and second. Yes, thank you.
Where the sign is.
Yeah. I should have checked.
Michael Baker says that many of us...
Could you hold on just 1 second?
While we're waiting for Dr. Bond to return, I'll share with you that next week we're going to have a talk from Kevin Sharp. And his title is The Works of Art That Got Me Through the Pandemic. We also invite you to come in person to the Dixon to see our exhibition, Impressionism. It closes May 9th. Please make a reservation and come. And if you are not an existing Dixon member, we do encourage you to join. And Dixon memberships make great gifts, including for your mother. Let's see.
I got very little of that, Sarah. I don't know. It seemed like you were breaking up.
Oh, no.
I don't know if anybody. Maybe it's just me. Maybe it wasn't anybody else.
Well, we'll do it again at the end.
Okay. I'm so sorry. This is household things interfering. I thought I had everything figured out, but it isn't. So, but that's okay. So I'm sorry, could you?
That's okay, sure. Michael Baker says that many of us only recently learned of the events in Tulsa, Wilmington, and other places. How many of these large riots and massacres do you think have been documented in the late 19th and early 20th centuries?
Oh, that's a good one. I think number one is going to depend on the time period, because Memphis is 1866, New Orleans is 1866. Then you've got a period where you don't have these large urban events in this Reconstruction period, but you do have violence that is, you know, it's just endemic throughout this whole period. Wilmington, North Carolina, is 1898, but that's in this period of transition to Jim Crow segregation. Tulsa is early 1900s. And then I think you also asked about another one, and I've just forgotten what that other one was.
Actually, it was just an all-encompassing all other riots and massacres.
Okay, it really depends on what the time period is. And I will say that racial violence, it's throughout the whole history. We can go all the way back to the colonial period, and there are examples of these racial violence, these huge urban racial conflict events, or rural. In North Carolina in the 1600s, you have the Stonewall Rebellion. You've got, of course, Nat Turner. Everybody is familiar with that one. In the Civil War itself, during the Civil War, you have a riot that takes place in New York City. It's the New York City draft riots. So the events, the information is there. The levels of violence, they're there in history. It's just a question of, I guess, the reading of history. So, yeah, I should just also say that, and I was hoping that question, this is one of the questions that I was hoping would come out, that when you read about 1866, probably if you read about it in Memphis history before, you saw it referred to as the Memphis Riot. But you've noticed that I continually call it the Memphis Massacre. And Dr. O'Donovan and I, and many historians who participated in this project, who are writing about this project, we did this on purpose, because the idea, the 20th century concept of a racial riot, for most of us from the second half of the 20th century, is the idea that you have African Americans who are rioting and destroying aspects of their own communities, community buildings and everything. Whereas if you back it up to the early 20th century, in kind of those post-World War I riots as such, it's just the reverse, that it's not African Americans who are the perpetrators of this violence and destruction. They are the victims. So they are massacres of Black populations. Wilmington in 1898, is a massacre. Tulsa is a massacre. Memphis is a massacre. So if you call these things what they actually are, it gives you an opening for exploring race relations in a different way, because you're not putting this 20th century imprint on events that are 19th century events, and you actually have an opportunity to see and to think about long traditions of race relations in this country in a different way. So
Thank you. I
kind of got to that. Yeah.
I'm seeing that my audio is having a challenge. I'm not sure if you can hear me clearly. Can you hear me?
Your audio. Okay, let me see if there's anything else in chat that I might be able to. Let's see, Dr. Lee says, the dominant story of race interaction in Memphis is the Tom Lee story. How would Memphis race relations change if the companion story was the Memphis massacre narrative? Would Memphis be closer to racial healing? Ooh, you have put me on a huge spot there. And I would have to say, I really don't know. I think I started with, I was born and raised in Memphis. I was raised, this gray hair is not dyed. I see many people who are obviously of the same generations that I have. I am. So I have a long history of Memphis that dates back to segregated Memphis. I went to segregated schools until I went to Memphis State University, where I got my bachelor's. So I've kind of shifted into this period of during the changes and the integration of the University of Memphis State and eventually University of Memphis, whatever. Would there be racial healing if we just knew about this? I think racial healing is going to take a lot more than just knowing about this one event, because this one event is just, it's just an example of what things were, it's just an example of what life was like at this particular point in history. It's Civil War Reconstruction Memphis. It's kind of hard to explain to people even the location of even the location of where these events are taking place. I'm sorry if I just totally forgot where the marker is. But when I say something like in the shadow of Fort Pickering, most people cannot even envision that there was this huge military installation on the banks of the Mississippi, because Memphians are not necessarily that particular about holding on to physical evidence of history. So holding on to these kinds of this kind of information that is not a physical evidence of it. I can't, you know, I can tell you where this massacre might have occurred, but I can't show you. The street names have changed. There's nothing really there. So I'm not so sure if just knowing about this one event in Memphis history is going to lead to racial healing. I think it's important that people know history. What is it? Those who don't know history are condemned to repeat it. Well, we keep repeating history over and over and over again. Even if we know history, we keep repeating it. So I think it's maybe understanding it and maybe not thinking that it's being rewritten. It's just being examined, because there are many people who would say, well, you're just trying to rewrite history by changing the name of the event. Or you're just trying to rewrite history by bringing all these things to the forefront. I'm really not, and I don't think historians are. We're just saying, if you know this, this might help you to understand Memphis better than the way that you think you understand it. It's like when people say, oh, I'm afraid to drive through Orange Mound. I'm afraid to drive down Park Avenue because I've got to go through Orange Mound. Well, that means that you don't know the history of Orange Mound, which is an amazing bit of American history and Memphis history. So I think if we know more about Memphis history, it might help us to understand Memphis more. Despite all of these terrible things that have happened, I would just tell you, even though I have now lived just on the border in Germantown, my next door neighbor is Memphis and I'm Germantown, I love Memphis. Like I said, I've always lived here. My parents have lived here, my grandparents. So, yeah. And I understand it. I know it and understand it.
We thank you very much for giving us this talk today, because I think all of us here have a hunger for more information about Memphis history, like you said. I apologize for my audio problems before. It also means that I'm not able to access the chat very easily. If there were any other questions that came through, but if you see another question you would like to answer, Dr. Bond, you may. But I also have some concluding comments if we're ready.
Well, you can just go ahead. I think I've probably covered all of them in one way or the other.
Well, thank you, and thank you everyone for attending. Next week's program will be from our director, Kevin Sharp. He will talk to us about the works of art that got him through the pandemic. We also invite you to come personally to the Dixon to see the gardens, make a reservation, and come see our exhibition, which is America's Impressionism. It is open through May 9th. And we also invite you to consider becoming a Dixon member. There are a lot of great benefits to it if you are not currently a member, but it also makes a great gift, and Mother's Day is coming up.
Sarah.
Yes.
Can I just was going back through, and could I just do two very quick responses?
Of course.
William McKelvey, the congressional inquiry, the government actually, they did this in two different ways. There was a military inquiry, because this was all tied in with military events, and then there was the congressional thing. And basically, African Americans went before these panels of either white military figures or white congressional representatives or their surrogates, and they were asked questions. And all of this was combined in reports that are very easily available in terms of how do I know what I know. It's because the reports have been published, and you can have access to these reports, to the congressional reports. They're online. They're easily available. So, yeah, that was the nature. So for the women, I'll say very quickly, this was really kind of a stunning situation because many of them are just maybe 2, 3, 4 years out of slavery, and they have to go. They do go before these panels of white military figures or congressional figures, and they are asked questions. And the reports are published in the Memphis newspapers. I should point out, Memphis goes back to normalcy very quickly because many people, this was in one isolated section of Memphis, and some people never even understood it had happened. You know, they could just dismiss it and say, well, it wasn't in my neighborhood. But it was published in the newspaper, the reports were. Okay, then there was one more. Paul Rhodes, do I expect this type of history to ever be taught in our school systems? When we did the commemorations, we had so many community partners that I think that, and this included school groups and the museums and everywhere, Civil Rights Museum, all of them. So I think that it is available there. It's a question of, is there time and space for teachers to address it? Before I did university, before I got my PhD and went over to university, I spent half of my teaching career teaching high school. So, and I was very lucky. I taught in New Jersey, and then I taught in Germantown High, at Germantown High, and taught in some really good situations. And it is extremely... High school teaching, elementary school teaching is so compacted that I don't really know whether this is taught or will be taught in schools, public schools or private schools. I hope that it will be. So, and those are the last two. Sorry, Sarah.
No, I mean, that's what this is for. So thank you very much. I see that on the chat that most everyone has comments of thanks. For you. So we do thank you very much for taking time and sharing this information with us. I hope we'll have you back. And to everyone else, we'll see you next week at Kevin's Munch and Learn. Take care.
Welcome back. And that was an interview and a lecture by Dr. Beverly Bond, a historian at the University of Memphis in Tennessee. And this is part of our Women's History Month commemoration here at the Pan-African Journal special worldwide radio broadcast for Sunday, March the 24th, 2024. We're broadcasting from our studios in downtown Detroit. We'll take a break. We'll be back with our concluding segment. the band, the voices of En Vogue from the 1990s, Don't Let Go. And you're listening to the Pan-African Journal, special worldwide radio broadcast for Sunday, March the 24th, 2024. And right now we want to move into our concluding segment. We're going to listen to some of the speeches delivered by Coretta Scott King, the late Coretta Scott King, who was the widow of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., was an activist and public speaker in her own right. And this next segment will prove that. Let's listen to some of these addresses delivered by Coretta Scott King.
Audre Lorde,
Muhammad Ali,
Stephen Biko,
John
Elijah
Coltrane,
Maya Angelou,
Odetta,
Paul Robeson,
Fannie Lou Hamer,
Rosa Parks.
The Pacifica Radio Archive celebrates Black History Month by honoring the voices of a revolution.
Malcolm X,
Gwendolyn Brooks,
the Black Panthers,
Roy Jones,
W.E.B. Du Bois.
From the Montgomery bus boycott to the Black Power movement to the fight for reparations, Pacifica was there.
W.E.B. Du Bois,
Lena Horne,
Huey Newton,
Geronimo Chijaga Prince,
Martin Luther King,
Bayard Rustin,
the Black Panther,
James Baldwin,
Cornel West,
Rosa Parks,
Mia Abu-Jamal.
Listen to these voices and you'll hear their dreams and demands for the political, social, and economic restructuring of America. To find out more, visit our website at pacificaradioarchives.org.
Dick Gregory,
Angela Davis,
Alice Walker,
Lorraine Hansberry,
Phillips,
Sonia Sanchez,
Esther Phillips,
H. Winnie Mandela,
Dorothy Daniels,
Audre Lorde.
And loved my husband so much. You who have kept alive the burning issue of war in the American conscience. You who will not be deluded by talk of peace, but who press on in the knowledge that the work of peacemaking must continue until the last gun is silent.
That was the voice of the late Coretta Scott King. I'm Ambrose Eileen, Sr. with Zarina Shakir. The Pacifica Radio Archives presents a special program honoring the memory of civil rights leader Coretta Scott King, who passed away Tuesday, January 31st, 2006. We will present the voice of Mrs. King herself in her own words.
Here on the Pacifica Radio Network, KPFK, 90.7 FM in Los Angeles, California, 98.7 FM, Santa Barbara, California, KPFA, 94.1 FM in Berkeley, California, KPFT, 90.1 FM, Houston, Texas, and WBAI, 99.5 FM in New York City. And we are broadcasting from the studios of WPFW, the Pacifica Radio Archives, a collection of over 50,000 recordings documenting the broadcast history of Pacifica Radio. The collection is considered by many scholars and historians to be one of the most important audio collections in the world. For this program, the archive staff located three significant recordings of Mrs. King, and we will share those with you today. For more information about the archives, visit them on the web at pacificaradioarchives.org or call toll-free 1-800-735-0230. That number again is 1-800-735-0230. Ambrose, so you have been very involved with civil rights, and I'm not interviewing you.
And very fortunately, I got to know Mrs. King. I got a call from the person who was running the Full Employment Action Council that she was the co-chair of.
Mm-hmm.
And he called me from New York and said, look, the labor unions are giving Coretta a hard time, and I need to add some people to the board that will challenge them. Would you accept if we got the offer? I said, of course I would. And fortunately, I was able to be of assistance to her in getting the labor movement to do the right thing about full employment.
Wow. And I might just say that I've just recently taken a new position with the Muslim Women Lawyers for Human Rights, and one of my major tasks is going to be working on civil rights.
That's
here
marvelous.
In the D.C. metro area. So back to where we are.
We begin this hour with the earliest recording of Mrs. King found in the Pacifica Archives. Now, the following speech Coretta Scott King gave in New York City 3 weeks after the assassination of her husband, Martin Luther King Jr. He had been scheduled to address the 27th Anti-Vietnam War Peace Rally. Speaking from notes found in his pocket after his death, Coretta Scott King delivered his messages to the group. The Anti-Vietnam War speech delivers the Ten Commandments against the war, ending with, "Thou shalt not kill."
And now, the Pacifica Radio Archives is proud to present Mrs. King, late April 1968.
My dear friends of peace and freedom, I come to New York today with the strong feeling that my dearly beloved husband, who was snatched suddenly from our midst slightly more than 3 weeks ago now, would have wanted me to be present today. Though my heart is heavy with grief from having suffered an irreparable personal loss, my faith in the redemptive will of God is stronger today than ever before. As many of you probably know, my husband had accepted an invitation to speak to you today. And had he been here, I am sure he would have lifted your hearts and spirits to new levels of understanding in his customary fashion. I would like to share with you some notes taken from my husband's pockets upon his death. He carried many scraps of paper upon which he scribbled notes for his many speeches. Among these notes was one set which he never delivered. Perhaps they were his early thoughts for the message he was to give to you today. I am sure he would have developed and delivered them in his usual eloquent and inspired fashion. I simply read them to you as he recorded them. And I quote, "Ten Commandments on Vietnam. Thou shalt not believe in a military victory." Number two, "Thou shalt not believe in a political victory." Number three, "Thou shalt not believe that they, the Vietnamese, love us." Number four, "Thou shalt not believe that the Saigon government has the support of the people." Number five, "Thou shalt not believe that the majority of the South Vietnamese look upon the Viet Cong as terrorists." Number six, "Thou shalt not believe the figures of killed enemies or killed Americans." Number seven, "Thou shalt not believe that the generals know best." number 8, thou shalt not believe that the enemy's victory means communism. Number 9, thou shalt not believe that the world supports the United States. Number 10, thou shalt not kill. These are Martin Luther King's 10 commandments on Vietnam. You who have worked with and loved my husband so much, you who have kept alive the burning issue of war in the American conscience, you who will not be deluded by talk of peace, but who press on in the knowledge that the work of peacemaking must continue until the last gun is silent. I come to you in my grief only because you keep alive the work and dreams for which my husband gave his life. My husband derived so much of his strength and inspiration from the love of people who shared his dream that I, too, now come hoping you might strengthen me for the lonely road ahead. That my husband gave his major address against the war in Vietnam. On April 4th, 1968, he was assassinated. I remember how he agonized over the great misunderstanding which took place as a result of his position on the Vietnam War. His motives were questioned. His credentials were challenged, and his loyalty to this nation maligned. Now, 1 year later, we see almost unbelievable results coming from all of our united efforts. Had we then suggested the possibility of two peace candidates as front runners for the presidency of the United States, our sanity certainly would have been questioned. Yet I need not trace for you how many of our hopes have been realized in these 12 short months. Never in the history of this nation have the people been so forceful in reversing the policy of our government in regard to war. We are indeed on the threshold of a new day for the peacemakers. But just as conscientious action has reversed the tide of public opinion and government policy, we must now turn our attention and the sole force of the movement of people of goodwill to the problems of the poor here at home. My husband always saw the problem of racism and poverty here at home and militarism abroad as two sides of the same coin. In fact, it is even very clear that our policy at home is to try to solve social problems through military means, just as we have done abroad. The interrelatedness of domestic and foreign affairs is no longer questioned. The bombs we drop on the people of Vietnam continue to explode at home with all of their devastating potential. And so I would invite you to join us in Washington in our effort to enable the poor people of this nation to enjoy a fair share of America's blessings. reason why a nation as rich as ours should be blighted by poverty, disease, and illiteracy. It is plain that we don't care about our poor people except to exploit them as cheap labor and victimize them through excessive rents and consumer prices. Our Congress passes laws which subsidize corporation farms, oil companies, airlines, and houses for suburbia. But when they turn their attention to the poor, they suddenly become concerned about balancing the budget and cut back on funds for Head Start, Medicare, and mental health appropriations. The most tragic of these cuts is the welfare section to the Social Security Amendment, which freezes federal funds for millions of needy children who are desperately poor but who do not receive public assistance. It forces mothers to leave their children and accept work or training, leaving their children to grow up in the streets as tomorrow's social problems. This law must be repealed, and I encourage you to join Welfare Mothers on May 12th, Mother's Day, and call upon Congress to establish a guaranteed annual income instead of these racist and archaic measures. These measures which dehumanize God's children and create more social problems than they solve. We will be marching toward Washington soon. On Thursday, May 2nd, we will return to Memphis to begin where my husband was slain and kick off his poor people's campaign. We will be marching toward Washington to demand that America share its abundant life with all its citizens. We should arrive in Washington by May 17th. I invite you to support the purposes of this march and to join us in Washington on May 30th for the Memorial Day weekend. I would now like to address myself to the women. The woman power of this nation can be the power which makes us whole and heals the broken community now so shattered by war and poverty and racism. I have great faith in the power of women who will dedicate themselves wholeheartedly to the task of remaking our society. I believe that the women of this nation and of the world are the best and last hope for a world of peace and brotherhood. This challenge is simply but profoundly stated in the words of one of the greatest black poets, the late Langston Hughes. He called the poem Mother to Son, but it speaks to the sons and the daughters of this generation and those yet unborn. It speaks of the determination and the indestructible spirit of a black people who refuse to be conquered. This spirit must somehow be imbued in the hearts and souls of women and their sons everywhere. Listen to this black mother as she counsels her son in all of her ungrammatical profundity. Well, son, I'll tell you, life for me ain't been no crystal stair. It's had cracks in it, and splinters, and boards torn up, and places with no carpet on the floor. There. But all the time I've been climbing on and reaching landings and turning corners and sometimes going in the dark where there ain't been no light. So, boy, don't you sit down on the steps 'cause you find it's kind of hard. Don't you stop now. For I'm still going, honey. I'm still climbing. And life for me ain't been no crystal stair. With this determination, with this faith, we will be able to create new homes, new communities, new cities, a new nation, yea, a new world, which we desperately need.
You've just been listening to the late Mrs. Coretta Scott King delivering her husband's speech to a crowd of people in New York City where they gathered at the 27th Peace Rally protesting the Vietnam War in April of 1968, 3 weeks after Dr. King's assassination. I'm Zarina Shakir in the studios of WPFW in Washington, D.C.
And I'm Ambrose Eileen Sr. You know, Zarina, as I listened to her deliver the speech that Dr. King had planned to deliver, it was as if he was speaking in 2006. We just heard the State of the Union address. What did Dr. King say? Don't believe in military victory. And what did the president say? We are winning the war. We are going to be victorious. He said, don't believe that the Vietnamese will love us. We were told when we went into that war that the Iraqis would be standing in the street throwing flowers at us. They would love us so much. We were told that there's going to be a democracy in Iraq. Dr. King says, don't believe that we're about democracy in Vietnam. He said, don't believe how they define terrorists. Our president last night used the word terror, terrorist, terrorism, at least 15 times. He said, don't believe that the generals know best. Our president told us last night that the generals did know best. Dr. King said, don't believe that the world supports the United States. Every evidence that we have been able to gather says the world is extremely disappointed with our performance, and they are not supporting us. And he ended, thou shalt not kill. And yet Johns Hopkins University group went over to Iraq and did a count, and they came up with at least 100,000 Iraqis who have been killed. The official count is only 30,000. You're listening to a special program honoring the memory of the late Coretta Scott King, presented by the Pacifica Radio Archives. Our thanks to the Archives and Brian DeShazer, Mark Torres, and Sean Dellis. For more information about the Pacifica Radio Archives and the historic collection, visit the website at www.pacificaradioarchives.org or simply call 1-800-735-0230.
Let me just say, Ambrose, in response to what you just mentioned in terms of that speech that she just gave, that it's so amazing as I listen to her, even listening to any of Martin Luther King's speeches, Malcolm X speeches, listening to that particular poem that she read from Langston Hughes. I mean, everything is as if it was just done today or yesterday.
Yes.
And it's absolutely appalling that people have not taken the time to learn the history, read the history, and how's it go? If we don't, we're doomed to repeat it, and God knows we are definitely repeating
yes.
this situation today. And, mm-hmm. you know, and let me just say also that it's unfortunate that Iraq and Afghanistan are not the only wars that are going on right now.
Right.
That there are, as I've been reading, somewhere between 40 and 50 wars going on in the world today. And unfortunately, we are a part of all of them. So,
Dr. King was right. He said, we are the greatest purveyor of violence on this earth.
I don't see how, you know, as I think about my son and my grandson, and I know you have children mm-hmm. and grandchildren, how, you know, sometimes we can even wake up in the morning, but we know that there's another plan, too, another plan that God has, and surely they will not succeed. So mm-hmm. let me just say that the next recording is a speech Mrs. King gave in Montclair, New Jersey, in 1971 at a Women's Day forum. Mrs. King implores women of conscience to find solutions to the problems facing the world, racism, poverty, and war, all still relevant issues today.
Mrs. King on this recording explains how the women of the world have the power to make the changes necessary to save mankind and womankind. This recording was first produced by the Southern Christian Leadership Conference and was the first in a series of programs presented by the Women's Collective at Pacifica Station, WBAI, in New York.
And can I just say also, as I think about it before we go into this clip, that a woman who has been representing herself and the loss of her son, Cindy Sheehan, that there she was attending the speech, State of the Union, which she really didn't want to,
mm-hmm.
and was arrested. And yes, women will lead this because as mothers, we are nurturers, and there are things that, I hate to say, you're a man, but there are things that we just don't believe. We just don't believe it.
You know, I had gone to hear her the night before the State of the Union address.
Mm-hmm.
You know why she was arrested? Because she wore a T-shirt that told the truth about how many of our boys had been killed.
Yeah.
As soon as she pulled off her coat, the same guy who had led her to the seat suddenly screamed that here is a protester.
Right.
And they rushed her out of there. And while he was doing that, the president was getting ready to talk about democracy.
Yeah. And where does the First Amendment come in?
Mm-hmm.
Freedom of speech? He has freedom of speech, but she didn't.
Yes, and a congressman's relative
was also arrested
done the same thing.
On the other side.
Yes.
Yes, yes. Well, let's just, I'll go back into, in the memory of her passing here, is Mrs. King delivering her speech entitled Women with a Christian Conscience, presented today by the Pacifica Radio Archives.
Whenever I'm called upon to deliver a Woman's Day address, I invariably find myself torn between two approaches, whether to address myself to women in particular or to the audience in general. Today I find myself in the same predicament. I'm using as my general subject the Christian witness in today's turbulent world. For the women in the audience, I shall address myself to the subject, women of conscience, what are you doing? As Christians, we have a special commission to be not only concerned but involved in the business of finding solutions to the manifold problems of our day. Therefore, it is important for us as individuals to recognize our true relationship to God, the source of our being. Then we can move out into the arena of action forthrightly, intelligently, and courageously. In the moving spirit of my constant and favorite prayer, God, give me the serenity to accept the things that I cannot change, courage to change the things that I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Each one of us here has a potential influence and power, perhaps unrealized. The question is to discover who we are, what we are, what we can do, what there is to do, and how we can best do it. We live in a turbulent, challenging, bewildering, and yet exciting, and even hopeful age. At times, it seems that the collective sins of mankind of all the preceding ages have been heaped upon the nations and the people of the world today. Likewise, are we the benefactors of the accumulated knowledge, technology, and wisdom of the ages? There is a multiplicity of problems facing mankind, but it is now possible to express them in three broad categories: racism, poverty, and war. Women of conscience, what are you doing for the children of this generation and the future generations? It is not enough to be aware of the urgent and crisis nature of the problems we face as individuals, as a race, as a nation, and as a world. It is not even enough to be just concerned about these problems. To paraphrase Dr. Benjamin E. Mays, the distinguished president emeritus of Morehouse College in Atlanta, Georgia, who has recently published a book entitled Disturbed About Man. We must be concerned to the point where we become disturbed about the problems of racism, disturbed about the problems of poverty, and disturbed about the problems of war. I have said many times, and I say again with even greater emphasis, that the women of the world have the power to bring about the creative changes that are necessary for the survival of mankind. There is a question as to whether or not man has the capacity to save himself and the great civilization which he has so ingeniously created. Woman can become the salvation of mankind. Does this sound strange, like heresy? To my ears and my understanding of my own nature, it is completely reasonable, sound, and logical. When we discover who we are and what we are about and seek to act on this, then we as women will know that we are the force that can make the difference between destruction and survival. What a tremendous challenge. An overwhelming responsibility and a great opportunity. Women, can we afford not to face the challenge or meet this opportunity? In reality, more is expected from those who have more to give. witnessing in today's turbulent world means, first, conscientiously seeking an awareness and an understanding of the issues and problems of our society and becoming actively involved in finding solutions to these problems. As Christians, we should always be in the vanguard of action. Wherever we live in these United States, whether in the rural South or the urban North, we are in some way affected by the conditions of our lives. I will not attempt to fully analyze the problems of racism, poverty, and war. There have been hundreds of studies conducted, reports made, and TV specials on these issues in which the facts are clearly established. I will only say that racism has so infested our society, and the behavior of most people has been conditioned by circumstances. The total result that racism has produced is a sickness which manifests itself in extreme behavior. We know what poverty means and how it has robbed millions of people in our nation of their dignity and self-respect, to say nothing of the basic needs of life. We also know that we as a nation have the resources to eradicate poverty. What we lack is the will. With television, even the smallest child understands the horrors of war. It is time for us as women to say with Theon O'Casey, the bells of the world have tolled long enough for death. Let them now ring for life.
You're listening to a special program honoring the memory of the late Coretta Scott King. You know, Zarina, as I listened to her talk about women, it reminded me of things I've said over the years addressing women.
Welcome back. And that was two addresses delivered by Coretta Scott King, one in late April of 1968. About 3 weeks after the assassination of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., her husband. The other one was in 1971. She was discussing racism, impoverishment, war, and the role of women. That's going to conclude our program for today. You've been listening to the Pan-African Journal special worldwide radio broadcast for Sunday, March 24th, 2024, and we've been broadcasting from our studios in downtown Detroit. If you'd like to have access to this program, just go to our website, and that is at the Pan-African Radio Network. You can reach the Pan-African Radio Network by logging on to blogtalkradio.com/Pan-African Journal. Log on to blogtalkradio.com/Pan-African Journal. If you'd like to read the Pan-African Newswire so you can stay abreast of some of the most pressing and burning issues of the day, just go to our website at panafricannews.blogspot.com. That's panafricannews.blogspot.com. We'll close out with the music and the legend of Nina Simone. This is a recording live at Ronnie Scott's Jazz Club in London, England. This is Abayomi Azikiwe signing off, and have a beautiful week.
I know what God is, but I do not believe in any denomination. I think it's necessary, and I know that ritual is necessary. And for whatever people need, of course, they should do it. But I do not believe in any denomination, wherever I am. If I need the solitude, and I often do, and the meditation, and the quietness, and the communication with God, I'll go to any church if I can find that atmosphere. But I will not get hung by it. No, nor will I get involved in it to the point where it dominates my thinking, and this one is better than that one. No, I will not do that. Music is my God.
From the depths of slumber, as I send spiral staircase of wakefulness, I whisper, God, God, God. I whisper, God, God, God. I want my food, and when I break my fast, nightly separation from thee, I taste thee and mentally say, God, God, God. No matter where I go, the spotlight of my mind is ever turned on thee. And in the battle of dinner or my activity, my silent war cry, God, God, God. When boisterous storms of triumph shriek, and worries howl at me, I drown their clamor, so much noise, dear God. So many people talking, dear God, all around me, all about me, all over me. God, God, God. No matter where a part of my mind, please hear the tone only. In the battle in with my activity, my silent war cry, God, 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 God. No matter where I go, spotlight of my mind is ever turned on thee. And in the battle, then prove my integrity. My silent war cry is ever God, God, God. When my mind weaves dreams with threads of memories, when my mind weaves dreams with threads of memories, on that magic cloth I do embark. I say, God, 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 God. When my mind weaves dreams, threads of memories, on that mountain cloud under the moss, God, 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 God. And waking, eating, working, dreaming, meditating, chanting, divinely loving someone. My soul constantly hums. Unheard by any. Yes.
I was born a child prodigy, darling.
Yeah.
I was born a genius, which means that at 6 months old, my mom said that I knew what notes were, and of course, on paper, and it scared her. So at 3 years old, I remember a piano came to the house. That's the way I have to express it, because I was poor, and I was a child, so I didn't know who bought the piano. And I remember playing a song, God Be With You Till We Meet Again, in the key of F, and of course I didn't know what the key was, so I leave that for you to scramble. So I didn't get interested in music. I was a gift from God, and I know that.
To my sons, one of them is called If You Knew. If you knew how I missed you, you would not stay away today. Don't you know how I love you? Stay here, my dear, with me. I can't go on without you. Your love is all I'm living. I'm living for. I love all things about you. Your heart, your soul, my love. I need you here beside me. Forever and a day, a day.
Tabby touch me, love you. From Havana, my mother was white as you are. She often said to me, my child, don't sell yourself for just a dollar. If you end up like me, God help you, kid. So think it over.
No, I'd only seen it twice in my whole life. The first time, I was too protected. My parents did understand that I was a gift, and I had a boyfriend, and I had was approved by the community, and I played in churches, and I studied. I did what they told me. So I didn't really know very much about that. We were poor, but I didn't know much about it. I knew it existed, but it didn't touch me. It touched me first time when I gave a concert, a recital at age 12, and they wanted to put my mom and daddy on the back row in the concert, in the little recital hall. And I remember standing up quite bravely and said, oh no, my mom and dad will sit on the front row. That was first. And the second one came was when I went to Curtis, and I passed the test, and I knew it was good. I was at that time kind of humble, not too much these days. But, and I didn't understand it. I was playing Czerny and Liszt and Rachmaninoff and Bach, and I knew it was good, and but we made records, but I didn't understand why I didn't get that scholarship for anything. And there were people around me who knew about my talent as well, and they said, Nina, it's because you are black. And I it shocked me. Mm-hmm. And I didn't take the time to let it sink in. I said, well, I just go where I can make some money to help my parents, who had moved from North Carolina to Philadelphia at that time to be with me as I studied. So I was quite aware that they needed some money to help them. So I took a job 2 weeks later in a popular studio playing for kids who couldn't sing worth a damn.